Well, we're going to come and look at this passage now, and we're going to look at verses 24 through to 31, and we're going to think about Thomas and his doubts this morning. So I'm sure that each of us have doubts as we come and approach Jesus, as we think through our faith in him, or maybe our lack of faith in him. We all have doubts that we have. And sometimes these can be doubts that are more in our mind. These can be things like questions of is this true? Does this all make sense? As we consider science and history and philosophy, is this true? We can come to the Bible and we can see all the stories and all the things that it asserts, and we can think, is that something that I can believe in my mind? But we can also have doubts in our heart. And that is a question more along the lines of, is this real? Does God really love me? Is it really worth it being a Christian? Both in terms of the difficulties that we face, but also in terms of the things that we have to say no to as a Christian. And we can also ask, why does God keep disappointing me? All these things that I thought that he would do for me and give me, but he keeps disappointing me. And so our hearts can start to doubt God. Our doubts can also take on a more social aspect as we look at other people and we can say, well, are they for real? Why are these Christians so disappointing? Why do they act that way and yet they call themselves Christians? Or maybe there's someone that you have known, maybe someone even that was important in your faith in Jesus, who themselves have turned away from Jesus. And you can say, well, if they were so instrumental in me becoming a Christian and they now have stopped believing, what does that mean for me? Now, of course, in reality, our doubts take on a combination of these things. It's often not as straightforward as mind or heart or a social aspect. All these things get very complicated. But as we come this morning, whatever our doubts, whatever the source of those doubts, I want us to have a look at this account of Thomas. And as we think through how we approach our own doubts ourselves, to think through for how it is that we would maybe begin to answer the questions that we have or other people would have about Jesus. But also, and maybe more importantly, is to look at how Jesus deals with people who doubt. Now, the context here, as we read the whole of the chapter, is that John is giving us evidence that Jesus rose from the dead. You see it there in verses 30 and 31. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And as you went through the chapter, I wonder if you noticed the things that John drops in to help us understand that he hasn't made this up. He's giving us this account based on eyewitness testimony. You see in verse 1 that Mary sees that the stone has been rolled away. And so she then runs and tells Peter and John. We're given people's names and we're told what they saw and what they heard. And so Peter and John then come in and they see the same thing with their own eyes. And so they go and tell others. And you see in verse 8, then the other disciple, that's John, talking about himself, who had reached the tomb first, also went in and he saw and he believed. He didn't try and fit his faith to the evidence. He allowed the evidence to guide him to what he believed about Jesus. And then we see Mary in verse 11, weeping outside the tomb. Now, this is really interesting. In the first and second century world, this is one of the critiques that was aimed at Christianity, that it was an emotional woman. So this is not me saying this, this is what other people are saying. It was an emotional woman who first saw Jesus risen from the dead. And yet, why, if you were trying to make up a story to fit that world, why is it that you would put that in? Well, you'd put that in simply because that's what happened. And so Mary then announces her eyewitness testimony to everyone, and she tells everyone in verse 18, "I have seen the Lord." And so we then come to verses 19 and 20, where we go away from individuals to a group. You can try and claim, if you like, that one or two individuals may see something, but for someone to appear to a group, that takes on a whole different level of evidence. And we see in verse 20 that the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. They see Jesus, they believe that he says who he says he is, and that they are then glad. And so John presents the evidence to us again and again, the things that they saw, the things that they heard, and so that they then believe and are glad. But then in comes Thomas in verse 24. And Thomas, I think he's your archetypal 21st century man. I imagine that he's walking in with his iPhone in one hand, his coffee in the other hand. He's wearing jeans and a ripped t-shirt, and he comes in as the 21st century man and he says, "No, I don't believe any of this. I know you think what you've seen. I know you believe that, but I'm not going to believe that. I will only believe it if I see it for myself." I think Thomas here represents probably many of us in this room who will only believe things if we have seen them for ourselves. And he comes in and he sets the evidence bar very high. Not only does he demand evidence, but he demands personal evidence, evidence directed specifically to him. And so maybe if you're a doubter this morning, maybe if you're a skeptic, either in mind or in heart, Thomas is the person for you, the person to follow through this story and hear of his experience of doubting before Jesus. And so he sets this evidence bar. He says, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." He sets the evidence high, but in verse 26, Jesus comes and vaults high over that evidence bar, as we're told that Jesus came into a locked room and stood before them. And so we're now presented in this moment of tension as the disciple who wouldn't believe that Jesus had risen from the dead is now confronted with the risen Jesus. What would Jesus now say to him? Now, as we come to look at Jesus' response, I've got 2 points this morning. The first point is Jesus welcomes examination. And then the second point is that Jesus answers our doubts. So we'll look, first of all, at Jesus welcoming examination. In verses 26, Jesus comes in and he stands among them and he says, "Peace be with you." And then he turns to Thomas and he says, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Now imagine at that point where Jesus turns to Thomas and is about to open his mouth, what do you think you would have said in that position? Or what do you think Jesus should have said? Well, maybe you would have said something like, "Why didn't you listen to me? Why didn't you listen to all the disciples?" It must have been a little bit awkward, to say the least, when you've got over 10 people saying they've seen one thing, and these are your good friends, and you're locked in a room with them, and you're telling them that you don't believe a word they've said. It's going to be awkward, to say the least. But Jesus takes a different approach. He doesn't come in all guns blazing. He's kind. He's patient. And he presents the evidence to Thomas. He says, "Here's the evidence, and so believe. Now, I think there's an application for us as believers that when people come to us with doubts or with questions in their minds or in their hearts, we too should follow Jesus' pattern. We shouldn't blow people away. We should welcome the examination that they want to bring. Because we can provide them with the evidence. We can say, here is what Jesus was like. Here is what he did. Here is what happened when he died and rose again. We can provide the evidence just like Jesus did. And then just like Jesus did, we can invite them to believe. Perhaps this morning you are not a Christian and you're thinking about it. Well, Jesus welcomes the examination that you want to bring. If you have questions, then Jesus is not afraid of those questions that you might have, because Jesus provides you with evidence of who he is, how he lived his life, how he died, and how he rose again. Jesus is willing to be examined, and he provides you with evidence, and he welcomes you to believe in him. But of course, there has to be some balance here, because I think Thomas is an honest questioner. He comes in, he sets his questions for Jesus, and he allows Jesus to answer them. You know, because sometimes we can move the goalposts, can't we? Particularly on a morning where my daughter goes to the nursery and everything's in a little bit of a rush, then we have to, me and her have to decide together what she is going to wear for the day. Now, I would much prefer it if she just every morning said, this is what I want to wear. And even if that something is completely ridiculous, it just makes my life easier if she decides what she wants to wear there and then. But as I'm sure any of you who've dealt with a two-year-old will know, that it's not always that simple. And whatever I pick, she will then change her mind 2 seconds later. And then I'll say, okay, you pick. And then she'll pick it out. And then she'll change her mind again 2 seconds later. And then in the end, we have to go route one, and she has to wear what I think she needs to wear. But she keeps moving the goalposts. And we can be like that when we approach Jesus. We can say, here's my question for you, Jesus. Here's what I want you to answer. And when we get an answer, we then move the goalposts and we doubt everything. We become chronically skeptical. A few months ago, I was listening to a conversation between a skeptic, an atheist, and a Christian. And the atheist asked the Christian, he said, well, what would it take for you to stop believing in Christianity? And the Christian very honestly says, just as the Bible tells us to, that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, if he had evidence that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then he would stop believing. And we're told in the Bible that that's the approach that we take. And then, having given that very honest answer, the Christian then turns to the atheist and says, what would it take for you to believe? And the atheist, again, very honestly says, I don't think there's anything that would persuade me. Whatever evidence you give me, I will find some reason to doubt that, even if it's doubting my very own mind's ability to take that evidence in correctly. Here was a man who couldn't believe anything. He was chronically skeptical. And what ends up is that he ended up going down a blind alley further and further. And so we can take that same approach. And so although Jesus welcomes honest examination, we need to be honest ourselves, that if we are going to set questions for Jesus, we have to be willing to accept the answers and not be chronically skeptical. But a legitimate question is raised at this point, I think, when Jesus says in verse 29, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And I'm sure many of us are like Thomas and are saying, well, unless I have personal evidence for myself, then I won't believe in anything. Well, why does Jesus say this? Well, I really struggle with this as I was thinking through this passage. Does he maybe mean, well, we're no worse off than Thomas? Is he just saying that we're on some sort of equal playing field? Is he saying comparatively speaking, maybe? Well, no, we have to accept that what Jesus says is what Jesus has said, which is that we are blessed if we've not seen and yet yet believe. So what is the answer to this? Well, the answer is comes to us in verses 30 and 31. And if you've got a church Bible, then I'm afraid you have possibly one of the worst title insertions in the Bible. For those of you who are maybe new to the Bible, the bits in bold, where it says the purpose of this book, they're not part of the original manuscript of the Bible. They're added in afterwards, to try and help us get our bearings when we're reading through the Bible, but it's not part of the Bible. And unfortunately, that title has been put in, which kind of makes us divide verses 29 from verses 30 and 31. So in your mind, or maybe with a pen, feel free to scribble that one through and remember that these verses come together. And I think what what Jesus is trying to get through to us, and John as he writes, is that those of us who have not seen Jesus but are hearing about him from the written testimony have certain advantages. And so the first advantage is this. It's that we have a certainty. We say to people, don't we, can I get that in writing? If we want someone to really back up what they're saying to us, maybe you've had a phone call with someone at work and you say, do you mind if I write this down in an email so that we're all certain of what we're all saying? Or maybe it's a letter from a company. You want to get that quote in writing. We ask for things in writing when we want it to be certain. And as I said before, as we've read through John chapter 20, we've got names applied to all these eyewitnesses. Here are people who have written down for everyone to see throughout all history, throughout all cultures. They can see who it is that saw these things, and these things are written down. I imagine if John maybe went up to people and said, can I put your name to that? This isn't like you're probably reading a lot at the moment about certain government sources and a person close to the prime minister has said this. These are people who aren't putting their names to what they're saying. But here in the Bible, we've got people writing with certainty and putting their names to what they have seen. So we have certainty. We also have a comprehensiveness. Sometimes when you see something for yourself on a personal level, it's not the same as seeing it from a more kind of global level. Whenever I go and watch a rugby or a cricket match, one of the first things I do when I get home is I read the match report. Why on earth do I do that? If I was there, I surely should have seen everything that I needed to see. Well, I didn't, because all I had was my own personal experience. And when you go and read the match report online, what you find is you find a journalist's point of view, you find the captain's point of view, you find the coach's point of view. You get a fully comprehensive picture of what has happened. And so, sure, Thomas had his personal experience, but that's nothing compared to getting the full picture that we have in the Bible of everyone's point of view, everyone's understanding and experience of what happened when they saw Jesus rise from the dead. And then another advantage that we have is that we have corporate access to this. This is something that we can all access together. There are certain worldviews and faiths and philosophies where it all depends on one person's word against another. But in Christianity, we all have equality of access to hear what Jesus said, to hear what the eyewitness testimony said, and we can all do this together. This, if you've ever been to see the crown jewels, then you may not have been able to pick them up and hold them and look at them closely, but the fact that they are there behind in those cabinets means that at least everyone gets to see them. Perhaps the intensity of the experience is not as great, but there's an equality as everyone gets to see them and enjoy them together. So there are some advantages that we have as believers reading these things that John has written down for us. We have certainty, we have a comprehensive account, and we can access this corporately. Now, as an aside, we struggle with this, I think, in our day and age, because we want to do things, we're so reliant, rather, on visual ways to understand things. Yesterday, we were trying to put up one of the gazebos at the Pumpkin Festival, and all I wanted to do was to get a YouTube video up so that I could see how it's done. I never read instructions anymore. And that can lead to us being a little bit biased against anything that is written down. And yet in the Bible always puts the primary emphasis on not what is seen, not what is heard, but on what is written down. And so Thomas comes, he sees the evidence, he believes, and then he worships. And we too can come and examine the evidence with Thomas, with certainty, to see the big picture and to enjoy that together. So that's the first point, that Jesus welcomes examination. And then our second point is that Jesus answers our doubts. So in the context of the whole story, we see in verse 25 that I think Thomas understands that if Jesus rose from the dead, it's more than just the question of did this happen or not. What Thomas understands is that if Jesus rose from the dead, we then get the answer to the question of, is Jesus God? We get the answer to the question of, did he die to save me? We get the answer to the question of, do I have to listen to every word? We get the answer to the question of, will I have to change my whole life if Jesus rose from the dead? And if Jesus doesn't rise from the dead, then we can then safely say that he is a liar or he's a lunatic. And this is something that comes up again and again in the New Testament, that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, none of this is true. But if he did rise from the dead, all of this is true. And Thomas goes from being a doubter to a worshipper based on the evidence before him. And so he sees this evidence, and then in verse 28, he cries out, "My Lord and my God." What's he saying here? Well, he's saying that Jesus is his Lord. He's the supreme authority in his life, that from now on, Thomas's life will be ruled and reigned over by Jesus. He's saying that Jesus is God. He's saying that he is the only object worthy of worship. He's the only person worthy of giving his life to. But he's also saying that this is something very personal. He's saying, "My Lord and my God." This isn't something out there for Thomas. This has become something that is very real for him personally. And it's so interesting, isn't it, that the thing that Thomas, I think, understands is that the key here is the scars that he sees. Because in seeing the scars, he sees not just a Lord and God who rules and reigns from afar, but he sees a Lord and a God who has come down to this earth, who has died an unimaginably painful and horrific death on Thomas's behalf. So he's not now cowering in fear. He is fearful, but he's also amazed at the love that Jesus has shown for him through dying and rising for him. And so although we could say that maybe Thomas's doubts were mainly doubts of a rational nature, doubts in his mind and his thinking, as those doubts are answered, his heart is transformed, and then his life will be transformed thereafter. We know that Thomas spent the rest of his life telling people about the evidence for Jesus, telling people about this Jesus whose scars he saw and he now worshipped as his Lord and God. We can't be certain, but most historians agree that Thomas died in India, telling people about Jesus, and he died for his faith. And so here was a man who went from doubting to worshipping, to being willing to die for his faith. So as we close, what about you? And what are the doubts that you have? Maybe they're doubts in your mind, questions of, is this true? Maybe they're doubts in your heart, is this real? Maybe it's doubts about other people, are they for real? Well, Jesus welcomes each and every one of us, whatever stage we're at in our lives, whatever stage we're at in our Christian journeys, he welcomes each and every one of us to come and examine him, to ask him hard questions. And Jesus provides us with written evidence of who he was and what he did and how he rose from the dead. And so Jesus then answers our doubts with the evidence. And he can turn us from being doubters, from being skeptics, to being worshippers, whose minds are convinced and whose hearts and lives are transformed, so that each of us can cry, "My Lord and my God." Shall we pray together? Father God, we thank you so much that you sent Jesus into this world to die for us, that we can hear of the written evidence of Jesus's scars that were there to pay for our sin. And we thank you that Jesus rose from the dead in newness of life. Thank you that he is the one who provides the evidence for us. And may each of us turn from being doubters to being worshippers who live our lives like Thomas, telling others about the good news of Jesus. Amen.